Welcome back to another edition of Conservation Stories. I'm excited today to be featuring good friend of mine, Kyle Bingham. Binghams have a long history with my family. Our families are both early settlers in Terry County. And I'd like to visit with you, Kyle, some today about, you know, your history, the diversity on your farm. When I think of diversity, I think of Binghams, and conservation really means diversity, diversifying. You know, we're understanding more and more about what that means to our soil and to our region. Could you talk a little bit about your family history and kind of where you guys started and how you kind of got to where you are now?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here today. So the land was originally settled by my great-granddad, Johnny Whitson Bingham. Some of this land that we still farm has been about over 100 years in the family. Then my great-granddad, Eddie, and his wife Peggy continued that, a lot of ranching, a lot of cattle. And then as my dad, Cliff, became more involved, he worked alongside Eddie and moved into a cotton and other crops they rotated. As they really grew in that journey, that from a farming perspective, that's when at the same time the industry was moving to a cotton after cotton GMO approach, cash crop only outlook. That's where he knew it wasn't good for the soil. He wanted to do something better. He wanted to conserve the soil. And so that's when he started working with a number of neighboring farmers to build out this certified organic and this organic approach and this conservation approach that we're continually renewing the soil. We're building that soil nutrients and working to not only produce a profitable crop but also do it in a sustainable fashion that's setting us up for that next year, for success for that next year. And we're not just living for this year and how to maximize this crop.
You know, one of the things I think is interesting is the way your dad approaches dry land, you know, and it's he's really able to be profitable in a lot of years that are really dry on dry land because of the way that he manages that. Can you talk a little bit about that management system and leaving that land fallow, how he does that for your family?
Sure, yeah. So his approach, like I said, is a multi-year approach.
Right.
Where that dry land, recognizing your water content, your water saturation from a multi-year outlook, that whether it's a ground cover, whether it's cotton, or whether that is going into a clean till, a clean fallow, to just simply absorb water and rest the land to set it up for a successful following crop, and where we've seen that to be really successful on dry years, is that the soil isn't that the profile isn't empty, and that there's still enough water and enough nutrients to still make a crop on even the driest years.
You know, I think that's one of the things that I see interesting that's developing is people taking like two different approaches, you know, of cover crops, and you hear people say, well, you can't have cover crops because there's not enough water. And then some people are like, yes, you can. And, you know, it's interesting to me to see the back and forth of that and how we're really still working all that out. You know, cover crops have been around in Texas and in our part of Texas. I mean, I can remember, you know, well, goodness, like in the 80s, probably some of that started. I mean, I know that my granddad was doing that, some of that stuff even in the 50s, and it's kind of just circled and cycled in and out and in and out and in and out. And then really, when you're talking about what happened during that, the culture change, really, that GMOs have brought into the way that we farm and the way that we manage farming. You know, it's not necessarily we're saying GMOs are bad, but it did change the way that we farmed and the way we manage that more, you know, long-term, long-thinking approach of how this is going to impact my soil. It's interesting to me, you know, to see your dad have thinking of those things all along the way. And, you know, he's kind of passed that on to you guys as well. And how do you see that impacting the way you make decisions and in the future, you know, that not just in this one area, but thinking ahead and managing ahead?
Sure. So one of the first building blocks of sustainability is water usage here on the High Plains. And so watching my dad calculate the amount of water used per profit made, I think, is important mm-hmm. for me to see, because that's a finite resource. Right. And that is a resource that if we want to continue to do what we do, you have to calculate that and mm-hmm. say, okay, what is, from a long-term aspect, what's a reasonable amount of water to be putting out on the soil? That's a big reason we've moved into vineyards, is that vineyards mm-hmm. utilize a similar amount of water per acre as cotton, and yet from a profit outlook potential, your profit potential mm-hmm. is almost 8 to 10 times the profit potential. Mm-hmm. The other thing we're seeing is that same amount of water is being used consistently throughout the year for that vineyard versus cotton. You're going to be hammering mm-hmm. those wells really hard for about 3 months.
Right.
And so where we do continue right. to water cotton, we're reducing that acres to make sure we're getting much more of a consistent pull on our wells to protect mm-hmm. that well mm-hmm. and that water source.
Yeah, so let's go back a minute just to the discussion on ground cover. And this can be kind of controversial. And I know that, like, when a farmer has found a way that a system works for them, you know, it's easy to think that another way can't work, you know. But I think there's more flexibility to that than a lot of times we are willing to, you know, admit. But you have some particular ideas about what's worked for you and what you know has worked for you. Can you speak to that some? Because you guys are organic, you don't have access to the same chemicals, so you're having to control your weeds in a way that now, when you think about climate smart farming, you know, they're wanting those no-till practice and those cover crops. How are you responding to that?
So I think I've seen a lot of farmers have a lot of success with that no-till approach with different soil types than we have in different regions from where we are, where when we look at it, a certain amount of deep tillage increases yields, increases water retention, and it really helps, like, expending that diesel, because that's an expensive diesel bill when you're doing mm-hmm. that deep tillage. Mm-hmm. is well worth it. And we can show some side-by-sides and some anecdotal things where it does increase the water retention. It does increase the yields. And so for us, we find that to be very successful. And yet I can go to a different region where they're running a no-till, where they're not doing any of this, mm-hmm. and they're improving their water retention. So I think mm-hmm. a lot of your outlook on conservation and your outlook with regenerative mm-hmm. ag is that you have to find what works for you, what's going to mm-hmm. build your soil. It's mm-hmm. going to take time.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, do you think that, you know, because some of the studies that we found, like for Lacey Vardaman, for her farmland, they've been doing, you know, cover crops when they have rain, but they're definitely on the no-till side, saving, you know, probably $80,000 a year. And what we found from ARS tracking their data is that they've improved their soil health and water retention. So I'm wondering if what some of that is showing us is that there's more than one way to skin a cat, so to speak.
I think when you look at Bingham and some of our farmland versus the Vardamans, is that there's actually a pretty good difference in how sandy our soil is versus mm-hmm. where they are at. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be some of your differences there. And we love working with ground covers, different aspects of them. I think there's a basic formula that certain people forget, though, when it comes to ground cover. Growing a ground cover is going to increase your water retention, but you are going to be expending available water to increase that ground mm-hmm. cover. So I think that using, like, coming in with a new ground cover program on a really dry year is mm-hmm. probably going to hurt you in the long
run.
You have to wait for that wetter year to mm-hmm. make sure you have mm-hmm. that available mm-hmm. water mm-hmm. To get that ground mm-hmm. cover because it doesn't increase your water, mm-hmm. your available water. It increases your available water retention.
Right.
And so you have
right.
to recognize that basic formula.
Right, right.
And that if implemented on the wrong year, I've seen it really hurt the cash crop in the following year. And
okay.
that kind of defeats the purpose.
Right, right.
So how you do it has to, you have to keep those factors in mind.
Right. This podcast is sponsored by Carter Key Farms. With roots stretching back to 1887, Carter Key Farms is a great example of heritage and quality. The Vardaman family, now in their fifth generation on the cotton farm and eighth generation on the ranch, continues a legacy of producing some of the finest beef and pork in Texas. This is the place where history and modern practices blend to create a product that stands apart. The farm's dedication to quality is evident in every cut of meat. Experience the exceptional taste of Carter Key Farms, from succulent steaks to savory pork sausage. Order your meat online today for local delivery or shipping at Carter Key, CotterKey Farms.com. So we could talk for a long time about all of this stuff because it's super interesting. And I think that one of the questions I want to ask you, you know, you're very specific operation. You all have found the way to make it work and make it profitable. And that's really, at the end of the day, that's sustainability, right? You're keeping in mind, you know, sustaining the soil, sustaining the water, sustaining the family farm. You know, that's really what it's about. And this kind of goes to this idea that we can find one solution and we can just make everybody do this one thing or these five things, and that will fix everything. And don't you see how that kind of goes along with how our culture is, that no one really has this middle ground approach anymore, you know? Or even sometimes I feel like we're untethered from reality of what people expect from those of us on the farm. But your family, you all, you know, your dad really started pushing the boundaries of what our culture was accepting when he moved into the organic world. And I remember I was on the other side going, this is weird. This is weird. This is like not going to work, you know? And here we are 35 years later. How can you take the lessons that your family learned? Like, how can we as, you know, a culture help other people through that transition period, you know, because there are things that are going to have to change here on the High Plains. We aren't going to have water forever. We're not going to have fossil fuels forever. And we're, you know, that's a big part of our economy. And we will probably all be gone by the time those things happen. But we need to be preparing the next, you know, generation to deal with the problems that we're going to be leaving behind. How would you, you know, how are you doing that with your kids? How are you doing that with the people around you?
Sure. So to go back to like, what are the principles of conservation? Mm-hmm. And the two really important things is, one, make sure the farmer gets paid. Mm-hmm. If the farmer's not getting paid, the it's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable.
But the second is, it's a continual learning process.
Right.
You're trying something. And if it works, you're taking the good from the bad. Mm-hmm. I think where I've seen my dad make some mistakes is when the new product comes out and he's like, okay, this sounds good. And he runs it on all the acres that are applicable.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't get to see what the improvement was. And he'll tell you this, like, that is, you're not learning anything by taking the new process and running it. And so that's something I've learned from him is you can bring it in and you trial it on a decent number of acres to see, you know, is it going to be successful? Is there a perceivable impact? Like, what's the, is it actually conserving water?
Is
it going to work? Is it not? Because if you have a wholesale change on a good year, you get excited about it, but was it the good year? Or was it the change in practices?
Right.
Because that's
such
the other
a
thing
good point.
You have to keep in mind is that farmers, we play by a different set of rules every year.
Right.
Every spring is a little bit different. The High Plains, our weather is so different from year in and year out. We can have a light winter, and then all of a sudden we've got all sorts of bugs and insects that we weren't expecting.
Right.
And then the next year we have this harsh winter and we don't have insects.
Right.
Issues, or we don't really see a lot, and so that keeping your eyes and your hands in the field to see what's changing, what's going on, and continually learning, and continually adjusting your practices is how you have to do this. We can't. Some of what GMO farming wanted to do was to give you a simple fix for every problem. And that's not how farming works. Even if you're using chemicals, even if you're not taking an organic approach, you still have to evolve and learn. And that's what your successful conventional farmers are doing and your successful organic farmers are both doing, is they're continually learning and adjusting to a changing environment.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, we always say about GMOs is it's like the internet. It's what are you going to do with that, you know? And, you know, they've been good, but they've brought unintended consequences that we, you know, still deal with. So let's switch gears for just a minute. So you diversified into organic cotton, and I know y'all tried chickpeas and black-eyed peas and sesame, and you just about pioneered just about everything, or peanuts. Y'all were some of the first. We were as well. But grapes, let's talk about grapes, because that has really made a large impact on the state. I know you've seen the new economic report that's recently come out from AgriLife that, you know, it's a $20 billion impact in our state now. And most of those grapes are being grown in the county that you are from, you know, thousands. What, we got about 5,000 in the state. Yeah, and so
that sounds correct.
Right. So really, you mentioned earlier we went through that transition, and our family did as well, to really conserve water. But then what you found is vertical integration is pretty helpful also. So tell us where you guys are in grapes now and where you're going.
Yeah, so with the vineyards right now, where we are slowly expanding our operation, a lot of it came down to the sustainability and the we saw from a good rotational system we're diversifying our income streams. We're also, with our vineyards, we've been able to limit our water usage per dollar made. And then as we got into that, when you look at the economic impact of vineyards versus cotton, is that we keep almost every single dollar of economic impact here in the state. Because of how it's done, that right there allows us to keep, that allows me to keep farming. If my dad was just growing cotton, it wouldn't, it'd cover his payroll and another guy maybe, but it's not covering my payroll. It's not covering other people who want to stay in the business. We're actually reducing acreage and increasing our profit and being able to allow more people to stay and continue to work with the vineyards.
Yeah, because you have a few in your family that might want to stay. Large family,
And that allows us to also build not only our soil and our land, but also our communities. Annual payroll for us has grown before vineyards was under $100,000. Same amount of land. That annual payroll is over $1.2 million at this point. And that is all dollars going into the local communities to neighbors. And those who have helped us build this farm.
I love that story. To me, you guys are the ultimate story of what a family farm, a diversified family farm, means to the economy of Texas. You know, to start out at, you know, less than $100,000 and now be at over $1 million, it's an amazing story. It really is. And you guys also were kind of the first to start talking about growing some hemp, and you and I've worked on that for several years through Texas Hemp Growers Association. And so I know y'all still have some products, and you're still participating. Give us a little more background about that and where you guys are going with that.
Sure. So yeah, with hemp, we still see some potential. We still haven't made any money there. We put our R&D money into it. We've put our time. We know how to grow this. We know how to build this industry. But at this point, I think we've got a good handle on, this is going to be a tiny industry. You know, there's talk of, when you look at your cannabinoids and your supplements and that kind of thing, you need about 2,000 acres of high quality biomass material to feed the entire U.S. industry.
What do we call that? A Jerusalem artichoke.
Exactly. And so there's value in there, yes. But farmers have flooded the market once. They can do it again if we're not careful. This isn't like it's going to be like the next wine industry. This is going to be tiny compared to the wine industry. As we look at some of the fiber and grain applications, I think that there's a lot of really promising things, but you also have to sort through mm-hmm. everything we've been promised, because a lot of it's simply not accurate or
Correct.
Doesn't apply to us.
Right.
Some of these rotational benefits, or some of the, you know, people say, yo, you don't need a lot of water or
right.
fertilizer.
Right.
Like, well, no, it's still a plant.
Yes.
We're still tying up our land,
right.
which is an asset to grow mm-hmm. this. This is not a waste stream. This is going to be a commodity.
Right. Right.
And so I think a lot of the industry doesn't recognize, if they want to build the industry, they're going to have to start by paying the farmer.
Right.
And I don't see that commitment from a lot of the industry players
mm-hmm.
yet. And I think that we're starting to move away from growing hemp and being heavily involved in hemp until the industry is really,
right.
really ready to come play as a professional.
Right. Well, and I think really the biggest issue that I've seen in hemp is that ag is not involved. You know, you have a few farmers like you all in the, and the board of the Hemp Growers Association, but until ag comes in and really says, we want to make this a crop, you know, it's going to be difficult. And I think that's something that, you know, to touch on the, we've seen in the past, you know, that you had corn against cotton and, you know, row crops against grapes, and then you have dairies against, you know, row crops. But I think we're starting to see a coming together of all of those industries. And, you know, we still have some issues. We won't go into detail about the issues that are happening across the High Plains with, you know, some of the chemicals that are harming the vineyards. But we really do need to continue to come together, right?
I think a strong farm is going to be made up of a strong rotational system to build your soils.
Yes.
Strong with a diversified income stream.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means is finding multiple crops that you're rotating through. That's where your success as a farm mm-hmm. is going to come from. And
mm-hmm.
so that's where cotton and other commodities working mm-hmm. together. They need to be
right.
working together for their constituents who are the farmer
right.
versus fighting each other to find out who's gonna get more federal money or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, if they're truly working for the farmer,
mm-hmm.
they
mm-hmm.
need to be working
mm-hmm.
for the farmer
yeah.
and working with other commodities mm-hmm. to help.
Yes.
I mean, it's going back to their constituents. Like that's what we
right.
need to be successful.
Right. You know, I think about when we first started investigating hemp, and something that Steve Verrett, who is a great leader in the cotton industry and retired now, well, he's retired from leading the cotton industry, but I'm sure he's on the tractor. But he said, if it keeps a farmer from going broke, I'm all for it.
Exactly.
And that is the attitude, I think, that we all need to have, is that we're, whatever we're growing, however we're diversified, we're all on the same team, and we're working together to conserve our water, working together to conserve our soil, and to build a strong rural economy.
Yep. Well, and a great example of that is that we had a dairy move in 3 miles away from us, and mm-hmm. our compost supplier, who
right.
was 70 miles away from us, set up their compost operation at this dairy, and now we're paying shipping
wow.
for compost for 3 to 5 miles versus 70 miles.
Right.
And that's a way mm-hmm. in which the compost and the dairy and the cotton farmer are all now we're all working together,
right.
cutting cost.
Yes.
And yet
mm-hmm.
the compost guy mm-hmm. is still getting paid to get his,
mm-hmm.
to make compost.
Yeah.
We just found a more efficient
right.
way to work
right.
together
right.
To find something.
Right. Well, Kyle, I really appreciate you visiting with us today, and give your family lots of hellos from me. And we haven't mentioned your mom much, but she was really instrumental in a lot of this. A very intelligent woman, and really, really thoughtful and forward-thinking for her time. And
absolutely,
I think
yeah.
she's done a lot. Unsung hero of our region. Before we close, would you give us a little bit of, what do you, you know, like right now, we know what you're doing conservation-wise. What are some of the things that you're interested in, that you're experimenting with, and where do you feel like you are going to be going in the future?
Sure. So some of the stuff we're doing right now that we're having a lot of success with some of the new vineyards we're planting, we're going to almost, I believe it's 80% recycled materials into our vineyards.
Oh.
We're using a lot of oil-filled pipe, fiberglass, sucker rod,
yeah.
and we're only purchasing wire, which is harder to reuse.
Right.
Something else we're trialing that we're just now getting into is we're getting into some more complex cover crops, to improve that water retention.
Right.
One of the disadvantages to complex cover crops versus like wheat or winter wheat crop is you lose that income potential. Mm-hmm. But in a vineyard, we're not really going to harvest it if it's a wheat or a rye. So that's another thing we're real excited to see, some of these really complex cover crops, to see if we can't improve our water retention even more. You get a nitrogen return from certain some of those species.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
so
kind of what
what's going to be in that mix? I mean, I guess you're talking about a multi-species mix?
Yes.
Okay.
You're going to see multiple cereals, some radishes, some legumes. Yeah, several.
Yeah, that's great.
I think we're looking at about 14 different things in there.
Wow, that's great. Great. Well, thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
Appreciate
thanks for
it.
Having me.
Appreciate it. And you guys, hope you enjoyed learning about the Binghams, and go check out their wine because it's fabulous, award-winning wine. Mm. And they also have some hemp products that are really great as well. Mm. So we appreciate you being here, Kyle. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.